Today's presenter is Justin Freeze. Justin has been a member of IBM WebSphere MQ Level 2 service team since 1997, in which time he has configured and diagnosed every product from MQ Series version 1 to the latest WebSphere MQ 7.0 release. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Justin.
Thank you, Elijah, and thank you, everybody, for joining or rejoining us after last week. I'm going to start right in with the presentation. During this presentation, we're going to start off with a brief review of Part 1, and then we're going to take a look at seven different problems that I managed to fake my way through. I set them up to fail, and we'll see whether the diagnostics in MQ enable us to diagnose those problems effectively. Along the way, we're going to be looking at several different topics, error messages, and something called error no numbers. We'll be looking at debug FFST files in WebSphere MQ, packet traces, and we will also be revisiting Keep Alive. And, of course, at the end, we will take questions, and I'll do my best to give you answers. So to review where we started off last week, here's a view of your network with your business application at the top, which is communicating over WebSphere MQ. So MQ is sending messages across the network. MQ is a TCP application, so it's talking to the operating system, which is sending TCP segments across the network, and those segments are included in IP packets. And then below that level, we probably are talking about Ethernet networks in many cases, I think, where these TCP IP packets are being included in Ethernet frames. And at the very lowest level, we're talking about hardware, where all of the data is flowing across wires and things in the form of bits. Moving on to slide number 4. A very quick review of the Internet protocol. As I mentioned, the Internet protocol, data is going to be transferred across the network as packets. The packet size is limited by the networking hardware. Packets are routed between machines based on the IP address in the packet header. And as many of you, I'm sure, are aware, there are two versions of IP, and the major difference between them is that the size of Internet addresses has multiplied significantly. So old-style addresses are like 192.168.1.100, and IPv6 addresses, I'm not even going to try to read it. It would take too long. Some characteristics of the Internet protocol. The packet routing between across the network is really from machine to machine. It's not really between applications per se, but between the machines themselves. Delivery of packets is unreliable. Things may get dropped or delayed in the network. The header on an IP packet controls how it is handled on the network. For example, whether a packet is going to be fragmented into smaller chunks or whether a too large packet is going to generate an error. And the packet payload is going to control or going to contain either data or something called ICMP control messages, Internet Control Message Protocol. And these are little error messages that indicate error conditions, such as you sent too large a packet. Let's go on to slide number 5 and take a look at the TCP layer, which sits just above IP. TCP basics, well, the data is transmitted as segments. However, each segment sits inside an IP packet. So generally, we refer to them as TCP/IP packets. All routing is handled by the IP layer. TCP doesn't really handle routing in the network. Instead, if we look down at the characteristics, it's based on communications between two connected endpoints. And by endpoints, I really mean a program on one machine and a program on another machine communicating with each other. TCP packets or segments have a header which adds reliability onto IP. There are sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers in both directions. So every byte of data is accounted for, and every byte of data is put into the proper order. If anything's lost in the network or arrives late, it will be reordered, it'll be retransmitted. TCP will do everything it can to make sure the data gets across the network, even if the network is not entirely reliable. And finally, TCP connections are very stateful. The state of those connections is managed by the operating system, by its TCP/IP stack. Let's go on to file number 6. And here's a quick look, very quick look, at WebSphere MQ and the sockets. WebSphere MQ sits above the TCP/IP layers, and it communicates with them using a programming interface called the Sockets interface, which was developed in the early 1980s at Berkeley. On the left and on the right, I've tried to show, for typical MQ channel processes, what kind of socket calls they have to do to communicate with each other. So on the left, we have what might be a sender channel. On the right, we have the listener and a channel pooling process. The listener, which is shown in green, waits for new inbound connections. It does this by creating a socket with the socket function. It binds to an address. So, for example, most listeners would bind to port 1414, although you may choose another one. And then the listener will listen on that socket for incoming connections and accept them as it receives them. MQ channels and MQ client applications, which would be shown on the left, must also create a socket and bind it to an address. Using that socket, they now connect to the address that the listener is on. So the address the listener is listening on needs to be reasonably well known. Once that connection succeeds, we now have an established connection between the channel and a socket on the server. That on the server side, the listener, as a connection is established, will pass off that connection to a pooling process in MQ. This is called AMQ RMPPA. So the listener confines its activities basically to listening and accepting connections, and after that, all activity is moved to another process. But over an established channel, either side can read, can write to the socket, or if they have to wait for a while, they will typically use a function called pull or often select, for example, if you're waiting for a response from the other side. MQ sends across these established connections something called TSHs, or transmission segment headers. It's an MQ data structure that precedes every communication that we do, whether it's control data starting up or shutting down a channel, your messages that are flowing across the channel, or MQI calls made by a client application. So that's the end of our review of part one. Let's move on to the first problem. Problem number one, the error. And I've tried to use several different operating systems to reproduce these different errors. We're going to start off with a Linux machine. You have a sender channel, and the sender channel goes immediately to the retrying state rather than running. If you look at the Queue Manager error log, you may see a message like the one below. I'm not going to go through all the fields in this message. I imagine you're familiar with most of them. But it does list the host name, if we know it. Oh, pardon me. Let me back up a little. The IP address and the port number that the sender channel was trying to connect to. And we see that, as the message reads, the attempt to allocate a connection or a conversation using TCP/IP was not successful. The error may be a transitory one, and it may be possible to successfully allocate a TCP/IP conversation later. Well, the text in this message is a bit of boilerplate. It's intended to be helpful, and it can be for many causes of this error. But the most important piece of information in it, to my mind, is the one I've marked on the left, that return code from TCP/IP, which is 111, or in hexadecimal, 6 fox. That's the real key to understanding why this channel went into a retrying state. So on foil 8, that number 111 is called an ERNO value. An ERNO value helps to explain why certain system functions did not succeed. So if a function like connect fails or any other socket function, the system is going to set the ERNO value to some number. And those numbers also have names that are associated with them. The names usually begin with E. On Windows, they begin with WSAE. I think the WS means WinSoc. And the names look like enomem, econ reset, eadra in use. There are dozens of these names. And the names are important because those are probably the names that you're going to find in reference materials when you look up, well, why did connect fail? Well, connect can fail, and it will list each ERNO name. The values for these different ERNO names, unfortunately, are not consistent at all from system to system. So here's one ERNO name, econ reset. AIX, it's a 73, HP 232, Linux at 104, and on and on. The only two consistency I see is between ZOS and ZVSE, where they both happen to have a value of 1121. So that's a bit of a pain that these values aren't standardized, but it's life, unfortunately. On FOIL 9, how can we look up, then, a number like 111 from our error message? Well, one tool that you may try using is the IBM Support Assistant tool, which is available from the IBM website. Another place to look would be System Documentation and Manuals. If you're running on AIX or ZOS, the IBM site would be a good place for this. If it's Solaris or HP Unix, you might want to look on the Sun or the HP site for information. On a Unix system, at least, your operating system may have a header file called airnode.h. It's usually going to be somewhere under the /user/include directory tree, and you could try looking there. Also on Unix and on Linux, you can look at manual pages to try to find airnode values, or you can just search the web. And on Windows, there's a nifty little program that I don't see used very often, but if you open a DOS command prompt and type net space help MSG space and then the airnode value, it will give you a description of it. So 10054 means an existing connection was forcibly closed by the remote host. It doesn't give you the name exactly, but the description is often quite enough to go by. FOIL 10. Well, I realize that it's kind of hard to look these things up. So at least for Unix and Linux systems, I just put together a new script, which may make life a little bit easier. The link in the middle of this page is where you can go to download it if you like. The script is just called airno, and you just give it the name or the number of any airno value that you want to look up, and it will do its best to find it for you. So, for example, on the Solaris 10 system, I ran airno 13 envval128, and it looks up each of those in turn. Airno 13 means permission denied. Enval is number 22, which means invalid argument, and 128 on Solaris, at least, means network is unreachable. Now, again, these numbers are going to be different from system to system. I don't think airno 111 exists on the Solaris machine at all. And that's the error number from this message we saw a few foils back. But let's look it up on a Linux machine. Airno 111 on Linux, where I reproduced this problem, is econ refused, or connection refused. So knowing that, what happened here? Well, we can explain econ refused. The sender channel tried to connect using the con name value in the sender channel definition. Under the covers, last week we talked about the three-way handshake that goes on when a TCP/IP connection is established. In this case, we can infer that the Linux machine, the sender channel, sent the first of that three-way handshake, a packet with the SYN, or the synchronize flag, and the remote system replied with a reset packet, terminating the connection immediately. And as a result, the system set the airno to 111, or econ refused. And on a Linux system, we can look up the how the connect function works using the manual pages. The man connect will return many error codes that connect can fail with, and one of them, econ refused, means no one is listening on the remote address. So in this case, we have a listener which isn't running on the remote side. That's a pretty common problem. Either the listener isn't running or we're looking at the wrong port altogether with our sender channel. If a listener isn't running, channels are not going to be able to connect. Message channels, by which I mean channels sending messages between queue managers, were going to fail. They'll print an error message like the one we've seen. If this were an MQ client program connecting to a queue manager, up through version 6, it would have failed with return code 2059, MQRC queue manager not available. As of version 7, this is something new that you may wish to take note of, MQ version 7 clients now have some more specific reason codes. Rather than just 2059, they'll tell you if there's a problem at the network level. And in this particular case, the return code would now be 2538, MQRC host not available. The completion code from the MQCon attempt would still be MQCC failed or completion code 2. So hopefully most programs are relying on that to determine whether or not they connected. Okay, let's take a look at the second problem. And again, with these problems, I'm not expecting that on your systems you're going to run into exactly these errors. I just hope that as we look at some typical kinds of errors and how we might go about debugging it, that you'll find that useful when you look at the errors that pop up in your own systems. So problem number 2 is on the Solaris machine. A sender channel, again, goes to a retrying state after 75 seconds. And this time it prints out a similar message to last time, but you'll notice that the error no value from the function was 145. Moving to slide 14. 145 is easy. We can look that up now with the ErrorNo script or by looking at documentation on the web. ErrorNo 145 is E timed out or connection timed out. And so why was there a 75-second delay? Well, in this case, we're back to the connect function again, trying to establish a TCP/IP connection, and back to that same three-way handshake. E timed out occurs when the machine that's trying to connect doesn't get any response at all. So that first SYN packet doesn't receive an acknowledgement, and the system will retransmit that packet after about 3 seconds, and if there's no acknowledgement, it will try again after delays of 6, 12, 24 seconds or thereabouts. And that doubling of the timeout between retransmissions is sometimes called exponential backoff. We just keep increasing it by a factor of 2 each time. Finally, after 75 seconds of receiving no response at all, the system will set the error no value to E timed out, and the connection will fail. The 75-second limit was chosen back in the early 80s at Berkeley, and it's still very much in effect today. Page 15. During that 75-second period, there's another clue that might be helpful. If you were to display the channel status, you'd find two fields in particular that are quite useful, and I've underlined them. First of all, the status field shows generally what is the state of the MQ channel. The Webster MQ Intercommunication Guide lists the various status values that you can have for channels. The one that we all like to see, of course, is a running channel. In this case, we are binding. The substate field is a bit more specific. It says, well, what is the channel doing right now? And in the case of TCP/IP channels, it often can be tied to a specific socket call. So here our substate is net connect. And if we go on to foil number 16, here are some of the substates that can be tied to specific socket activity. The first one is the substate name server. If you see that substate on the channel, it means that it's trying to resolve an address to an IP number. So a host name, for example, it needs to be translated to an IP address like 192.168.1.11. And that typically relies on a DNS server. If the name server isn't responding, then you may see this substate. NetConnect, that substate specifically means the connect socket call in TCP/IP. The send state on a channel means that we are trying to write to a socket. On some systems, the actual socket call is send instead, or that we are waiting to write to a socket. And there we'll either use the pull function or, on some systems, the select function. And finally, the receive substate means that we're trying to get data out of a socket, either using the read or receive functions, or that we're waiting for data to receive on a socket, and again, using pull or select to wait for data to be available. Also, if we were to go to the command line, there is a program called netstat on just about every system out there that will show you the status of TCP/IP connections. I've run netstat on this system with the flags minus A, N. Minus A shows all connections, and minus N says, just give me the IP addresses. Otherwise, NetStat can take a while to run as it tries to look up host names for everything. I'd rather it just give me the output quickly. And in this case, I see that our connection to Remote address 192.168.1.11, port 1427, which is shown in the middle, is in a state SYN_sent, which is on the right-hand side. And the SYN_sent state means that it has sent a SYN packet and it has not received an acknowledgement from the other side. Also interesting here is that we can look at the send-Q and receive-Q columns, and we can see that there is no data waiting to be sent or waiting to be read off of this socket, so there's no data at all. If we were to run this netstat command on the other machine at the same time, we would find absolutely nothing for this connection. And as we move on to FOIL 18, this is the same TCP state diagram I showed in part one. And again, you can find other versions of this on the net with a fairly simple search. So what has happened here is our sender channel started off in the closed state at the top of the FOIL, and it issued a connect call. So it's following that red arrow down into the left to the SYN state. And if you look just to the right of that red arrow, you'll see that it has sent a packet with the SYN flag. And that packet is the first of the three-way handshake, which are labeled 1, 2, and 3. So in order for us to get stuck in the SYN_sent state, either the other side didn't receive our SYN packet, or it received it and decided to ignore it, or it received it and it did send the response, but somehow the response never came through. So there are several different reasons why we might get stuck here. In FOIL 19, here's the explanation. In this particular case, I actually had a firewall that was running on the machine I was trying to connect to. And the firewall was in stealth mode, which means that it was ignoring and not even responding to incoming connections. Now, the solution to this sort of problem is to open up a port in the firewall so that a connection can be made to the MQ listener. Another explanation I've listed at the top, if there are no reply packets, sometimes that means that the target machine is simply offline. So it's also something worth checking for. Okay, let's go to FOIL number 20 and the third problem. All right, imagine you're running a queue manager, and every now and again, a pair of messages shows up in your queue manager error logs. The first message says, AMQ 9209, connection to host closed. An error occurred receiving data over TCP/IP. The connection has unexpectedly terminated. And immediately after is an AMQ 9492 message. The TCP/IP responder program encountered an error. It all sounds very dire, but it's actually, as we'll see, not too much to worry about. And the key to look at here is the explanation. The responder program was started but detected an error. So let's move on to FOIL 21 to see what exactly is meant by the responder program. The TCP/IP responder program is a process in which an accepted channel connection runs. So earlier in this presentation, I showed something that looked a little bit like the diagram to the right. It showed the listener in green, which creates a socket, binds it, listens on, say, port 1414 or some other port, and then accepts connections. And as each connection is accepted, it passes that connection off to a channel pooling process called AMQ-RM-PPA. In this case, the responder program is AMQ-RM-PPA. That's where the socket lives while it is active. Another way of doing this, at least on Unix systems, is to use something called the INETD daemon. INETD is sort of a generic listener. It will listen on whatever ports you tell it to, and whenever it accepts a connection on the port, it will kick off whatever program you direct it to start. So it is possible on Unix to use INETD instead of RunMQLSR, and you'll see that it does the same exact socket calls. The reason it's able to do that is that none of those socket calls are particularly special to MQ. Any program that wants to listen has to do those. INETD, when it accepts a connection, will kick off a program, a dedicated program for each socket connection called AMQ-CRSTA. So those programs are not threaded. Every single connection is going to kick off another one. And that's why we recommend not using the INETD daemon these days. If you have thousands of clients connecting, you're going to have thousands of AMQ CRSTA programs. And you can run into limits on how many programs your MQM user can actually run. The AMQ RMPPA pooling programs are much more advanced in that they can support a configurable number of channels, usually on the order of 50 to 60 channels, and they try to balance the load across the AMQ RMPPA processes if you have more than one. So it's, I think, definitely the way to go these days. So we know from our error message that the responder program failed, and since I was using RunMQ LSR, that means it's AMQ RMPPA. And that furthermore means that the listener did its job just fine. RMPPA is busy doing calls like read, pull, and write, so presumably one of those failed. Problem three, well, there's some missing information in those two error messages we looked at two foils ago. In particular, there were no ErrorNo values at all. There was no code 111 or anything like that. In fact, I'm just going to back up a little bit so we can take a look at those. So you see here, no ErrorNo code. There's not even a TCP/IP socket call like connect failed or something like that. Nothing. Just the connection just closed. And closed in this case means that the other side actually closed the connection without an error. Going back to the previous presentation, part one, we said that the connection gets closed when one side sends a fin packet saying, I'm finished for this connection. And that's what happened here. The other side closed the connection, the fin packet came over and was acknowledged, and so the channel pooling process says, well, if you're closed, then I'm closing too. But we didn't expect that to happen. When a connection comes into an MQ listener, we expect a channel negotiation to go on, another MQ activity. So that's why the AMQ RMPPA process reported an error here. Another interesting thing about these messages, before this 9209 or the 9492 and after it, there is no channel started message and no channel ended abnormally message either. So we had a connection come in, but because it never did any of the MQ negotiation, it was never actually a channel. Well, what's the explanation? And I'm going to skip forward a few foils now. The explanation here is that this was probably due to a port scanner. A port scanner is a program that's going to connect to any ports that it can just to see which ones are being listened on. And in many cases, port scanners, as soon as they connect, will just immediately close the connection. A port scanner might be used by your security teams, but it's also a tool that hackers can use to try to figure out which ports should they try to attack. So I would very much hope that if you see this, it's a case of your security teams doing a scan. Now, WebSphere MQ7 also changes behavior here a little bit. By default, it no longer reports these two messages for a port scanner. So if somebody connects to the MQ listener and immediately closes that connection, version 7 will ignore that by default. And the reason is that the two messages did look awfully dire, like something serious was happening, when in fact there really wasn't much going on. If you want to see those two messages, it is possible in version 7. You just have to start the listener with an environment variable set, MQ_report_network_probe=1. And if you do that, you will get the two messages again for port scans. Okay, on to problem number four. The error in this case is a little different. We have an AIX sender channel, which hangs for 5 minutes when starting. And the error message here looks fairly familiar again. It's that same 9202 message we've seen twice before, except that we have a bit of a problem. The ErrorNo value, which the little hand is pointing out, is 0. Well, that seems a little unexpected. And moving to foil 25, here's why. ErrorNo 0 doesn't actually exist. Typically, 0 means something succeeded. So if we try to look it up, for example, using that ErrorNo script, it will say not found. So what was going on for that 5 minutes while the sender channel was sitting there? The NetStat program, if you try that, won't show you anything on this side, the AIX machine, or on the remote system at all. And that means that in this particular case, there really isn't a connection yet. We're running into trouble even before establishing a connection. On foil 26, Here, the MQ channel status can give us a better idea what's going on. It's worth noting that MQ channels have a status even if they don't necessarily yet have a connection. So sometimes channel status will help where TCP/IP tools like Netstat will not. And in this case, I've chosen to display this channel status, and I've also asked for another field of the channel status called job name. The default display channel status command shows, say, the most popular fields, so to speak. But you can add other fields, or you can use the attribute all, display channel status all, if you want to see everything. So what do we see here? Our channel is again in a binding status, just like last time. And we're in a substate of name server, which I discussed earlier. So it looks like we're having some trouble looking up the IP address for a host name. And the job name attribute, I requested it so we could look more at the channel process while it's running. The job name is actually two fields merged into one. The first half of it is the process identifier that the channel is running in, and the second half is a thread identifier inside that process. But both of them are in hex and smushed together, which doesn't seem to be the most friendly way to display that information, but, well, you can work out the process name at least. In this case, it was hex 155010, which works out to PID number 1396752. So if the substate name server weren't enough to clue me into what's going on, I could try getting some debug information from this channel. Debug FFSTs. Well, FFST is an IBM term that means first failure support technology, if I have it right. And an FFST in MQ, we often refer to those as FDC files. You're typically going to see these in your top-level errors directory. You're going to have a file named AMQ followed by a number .fdc, which is why we sometimes call them FDCs instead. I think the file name extension comes from the days when Windows only supported 8.3 style file names, if you're wondering why there's a difference. So with a debug FDC, the way we can get that on Unix is to send a special signal called sig_user2 to the PID that is running our channel. And there's an example of how to do that on Unix and on Linux systems. kill-usr2 and then the PID. On Windows, MQ ships a program which can do the same job because, of course, we don't have the kill program on Windows. That program is called amqldbgn, and then the argument is minus p, and then the process identifier, which you can get from the task manager as well, but the channel status is probably the best place. Something to note about both of these commands is that they're not going to actually give you any output themselves. Nothing will appear to the screen. Instead, they're going to cause that channel process to write out an FDC file, or an FFST if you prefer. So we need to go to the top-level errors directory and look at the file. Foil 28 shows part of the file. FFST files are huge. If I were really to try to include the whole thing, this presentation would probably be another 100 slides or so. So here is some of the header fields at the very top of an FFST, which are some of the most useful ones. I can see the date and time that we did the kill, or the AMQLDBGN command. It'll show us the version of the product, the operating system, WebSphereMQ for AIX in this case. And then we have this value called the probe ID, which you may have seen in other FFSTs before. The probe ID is just meant to be a really good argument for searches. And however, in this case, I don't think it's likely to be quite as helpful. All debug FFSTs end with number 255. And that really means that the FFST was sort of artificially generated. So what happened here is that when we sent that signal or ran the AMQLDBGN command, it directed this process running the channel to dump an FFST, showing what is it doing right now. And this can be useful for not just channel problems, but any kind of process in MQ that appears to be hanging or not responding. The component field shows the name of the process or the function that we're executing. CCI TCP resolve hostname. Well, that's some of the MQ internal code, But the name of the function is pretty useful in and of itself. It looks like we are trying to resolve a host name. We give the program name, its process ID again, and then we have this thing called the function stack, which reads from top down, how did we get to this point? So the top-level functions, RRI caller, RRI caller entry, these are the lowest-level functions in an MQ channel. RRI init ses means that it's trying to initialize a session to a remote system. And CCI TCP alloc cons means that it's trying to allocate a conversation. Finally, CCI TCP resolve hostname means that we only got so far as trying to resolve the hostname, and that's where we got stuck when the FFST was requested. Let's go on to FOIL 29. On some other operating systems, we can actually get even more detail than MQ can provide for us. There's a little script called Stackit, which is available on the IBM website, at least for AIX and Solaris at the moment. Usually this needs to be run as root for MQ processes. But the Stackit program, you can use it to show what's going on inside a process using the minus P flag. You can look at particular MQ or even non-MQ process names by giving the name with the minus N flag. Or you can even match part of the command line arguments using the minus M flag. One word about scripts like Stackit, these are really should be used mostly when working with IBM support. In some cases, they will do things like run a debugger against the process, which is not something you necessarily want to be doing on your production systems. There's always the possibility, even if it is quite slim, that something like Stackit could actually terminate a program if something goes wrong. So do have a bit of a care if you're using these, and in all likelihood, you probably ought to wait unless you're working with level 2 or level 3 MQ support. So what does Stackit output give us? Well, here's FOIL 30. It gives us a lot more detail than MQ can. For the most part, we're going to get Stackit output if we suspect that the problem may actually be in the operating system itself. And mostly that's because underneath the CCI TCP resolve hostname function, that's as far as MQ took us, Stackit or similar scripts will show what was happening under the covers there. What's happening inside, say, the C runtime library? Well, yeah, see, we're doing a get addr info function. And then we can see, well, what does get addr info call? And work our way down. At the very lowest level, up here at the top, we see that the operating system is doing some form of a poll function, which means that it's waiting for data, presumably on a socket or a file of some kind. So that's some of the extra information that we can get from something like Stackit or from a debugger. Moving on to FOIL 31, here's the explanation. And really, we didn't need to do the debug FFST or the Stackit or the rest of it. The channel status really gives this to us, but I just wanted to show those as an example. The name server substate means that we're waiting to resolve a host name. In this particular case, I changed the name server address in the operating system to the wrong address. So I was talking to the wrong machine and couldn't resolve any host names at all. The error message that we saw back at the beginning is a little bit misleading in this case. It showed us error zero, which again means no error at all. The reason it showed error zero is that MQ never even got so far as trying to connect across using a socket. There was no TCP connection, no netstat output, no error no at all. And I will say that for this particular message, we're actually looking at this to see if we can perhaps improve that message, and I think that that's something that will happen in upcoming maintenance. Problem number 5. Let's move to something new. Imagine now that you have a sender channel that is actually running, but occasionally it runs a bit slowly. You think you have a performance problem. And there are no messages at all in any of the logs. The channel stays running. It just doesn't go quite as fast as you'd like. Well, in a case like this, it's helpful to look at both sides of the channel to see if we can figure out which side is really experiencing the problem. If we look at the sender channel, looking at its channel status, we see that it is running, and the substate on the lower right there is send, which means it's trying to write data to its socket so that it will go across the network. So that's good. That's the kind of state that we want to see a sender channel in. if we go to foil 33, I generated another debug FFST for this sender channel using the same method as before to see what it's doing. And the component name that it's waiting in is a function called xcswaitfd. Well, waiting isn't certainly good for performance. We'd rather it be doing something. So what does waitfd do? Well, this is the function that calls poll or select, and it's waiting for the socket to be able to accept more data. Poll and select can be used both from somebody who's sending data to a socket, and also it can be used more often when somebody's receiving data off of a socket and there's none available. So when we're trying to send data and we've called poll, what does that mean? We'll find out in just a moment. First, let's take a look at the receiver side. Again, no error messages in the log, and the channel is in a running state. If we look at the substate, we see that it is a receive substate. So this channel is busy reading data off of its socket. I generated another debug FFST against this channel process, and I find that it's in the function CCI TCP receive, which is good. So it's busy reading data off of the TCP socket. One thing I don't see here is I don't see XCS wait FD. This channel isn't waiting. It is busy reading actual data. And as it reads messages off of that socket, it will put them to the destination, go off, and get more data off the socket, and put that message to its destination queue, and so forth. So our sender is busy trying to send data, and our receiver is busy reading data off the socket. So is there a communications problem here? I'd say probably not. If our receiver channel were also waiting on the socket, then we'd have a weird case where data might not be getting from the sender to the receiver. They're both waiting. In this case, it's the sender that's waiting, and it's the receiver that's busy trying to catch up. We could take a packet trace to be absolutely certain about this, and we could look for missing packets. Or we could look for something like selective ACK going on, which we described in part one. Selective ACK occurs when there's a hole in the data sequence, which means that a packet was lost. But I suspect in this case the receiver just isn't keeping up with the sender channel, and if we were to take a packet trace, we'd probably find that its window is closing or closed, which means that it can accept 0 bytes of data from the sender side. So one way, at least on AIX and some other systems, of getting a packet trace is with a command like TCP dump. I have to tell it what we want to look for. I want it to dump all packets from 192.168.1.11 and port 1427, which is the port that the listener is on. If I go to page 37, here is what the packet trace that came out looks like. I happen to use a tool called Wireshark to look at it, but there are other programs as well for looking at packet traces. I have to say, I'm guessing that in most cases you're probably not going to have to get down to this level, but if you really like packet traces, you're welcome to have that. And on the right, I've tried to highlight in red, or underline, the cause of the problem. Every packet, the packets are alternating. The first packet, for example, is from the sending machine, and the second packet is an acknowledgement from the receiving machine. And its window, or how much data it can accept, is over 30,000 bytes. Packet 3, the sender channel, sends some more data, about 8,000-some bytes. And now the receiver only has room for 22,000 bytes more. So the sender sends another 1,200 bytes, and the receiver now can only accept 2,100 bytes or thereabouts. Sender sends 16,000. Now the receiver is down to a window of just 4,500 bytes. So as you can see, this window is dropping and dropping and dropping, which means that the sender is getting its data across, and the receiver is not reading it off the socket very quickly. Packet 37, I guess it is, go looking at that number on the left, the sender sends 3,400 bytes, and hey, presto, the receiver window has gone up to 10,500. So that indicates that the receiver did read some data off the socket because suddenly it had room for more. But what happened next at packet number 39? Since the receiver said, I've got room for 10,558 bytes, the sender sent that much data in a packet. So it sent as much as it could. And what did the receiver do? It responded with a packet that had a window of zero, meaning I am full. I can't accept any more data. So now here, if we look at the timestamps on the left between packets 40 and 41, you'll see that 5 seconds go by before the sender sends another packet saying, you know, I'd like to send some more data to you. And immediately in packet number 42, the receiver side again says, window equals zero. I have no room. So this is a case where the receiver channel just is not keeping up with the volume of data from the sender channel. And the packet trace confirms that as we see the window dropping to zero. And here's what it looks like. The sender channel is running faster, which means the socket buffers are full in one direction. So over on the left here, anybody who wants to write to this socket on the sender is going to have a problem. There's no room for any data. And TCP/IP can't help us too much because if we look at the receiver buffer, it's completely full too. There's no room to accept any packets. What has to happen is that the receiver needs to read data, which will make room in the receive buffer, and then TCP can send that data across and the sender channel can write more data to the socket. Now, this may not be a problem. Between any two machines, one is going to be faster than the other. If we had, for example, a sender channel on a big mainframe machine and a receiver channel on an old system, this is probably where things will end up at some point. But if you're looking for a performance problem, this gives us a big clue here. We could take a look at the receiver machine and try to figure out, is there a lot of activity running at this point? Did somebody start up a program that's chewing up a lot of CPU? Why is that receiver being slow? And that's where I would go next. Problem six. Let's get back to Keep Alive, which seemed to be popular based on the questions in the first part of this class. Let's imagine now that you have an MQ client program, which after some period of inactivity fails with reason code 2009, which means MQRC connection broken. The client is connected to the queue manager through a firewall. Well, we discussed that in part one that this is a fairly common scenario these days. Firewalls and some routers these days often like to kill connections that are idle for too long. And a common timeout that we see here in level 2 support is 60 minutes, 1 hour of inactivity, and bam, your connection is killed. We could run a packet trace, and the packet trace would probably show that a reset packet is being received, and the reset packet is being generated from inside the network by the firewall. It's being sent in two directions, down to the client and up to the MQ server as well, so that both sides will clean up and go away. And the solution is to enable Keep Alive for the queue manager, which on Unix and Linux systems at least is done by editing the qm.ini and adding tcp:keepalive=yes. And on Windows, you can right-click on a queue manager in the Explorer and set the Keep Alive option. So how do we tune Keep Alive? Because by default, Keep Alive is going to kick in and test the connection and make sure that it's still viable after 2 hours of inactivity. And 2 hours is too long in most cases. If you do have a firewall that kills connections, it's probably going to do so in about an hour. So we would really like that the Keep Alive timer should kick in less than an hour, maybe on the order of every few minutes, and send a test packet down the connection and get a response. And that little bit of activity, even when MQ is not sending data, is enough to keep the connection alive as long as it needs to run. So here are a few foils now about how to set the Keep Alive timer on various operating systems. On AIX, the parameter is called tcp_keep_idle, and the program that you can use to change it is called the NO program, or I guess for network options. Now, if you run NO-H and give the parameter name, it'll describe it for you, tell you what it's about. Most useful, I think, is NO-L, tcp_keep_idle, which will show the parameter, its current value, the default value, what the value is going to be the next time the machine reboots, minimum, maximum values, and also the unit. So the keep idle parameter, this is a little unusual, AIX only I think does this, is stored in half second values. So if you want to change it, for example, to 5 minutes, you really need to set it to 600 half seconds, which is 300 seconds, which is 5 minutes. And you can do that with the NO command. If you want the value change to be permanent across reboots, add the minus P flag and do an NO minus PO, TCP keep idle equals 600, and that will do the job for you. This needs root access to do this kind of thing. For HP Unix, the parameter name is a little bit different, and so is the program that you use to change it. It's called NDD, and the parameter name is TCP keep alive interval. Also, it's stored in milliseconds. So if you want to change that parameter, just do an NDD minus set slash dev slash TCP, give the parameter name, and 300,000 milliseconds would be, say, 5 minutes again. If you want the change to be permanent, you're going to have to edit a config file on HP. I've listed the file names there. And you'll have to add 3 lines to it. And those 3 lines, which I've shown below, will cause HP on each reboot to set the parameter to what you want. On Linux, parameter is TCP keep alive time. And we have a different program yet again for changing it, sysctl. So using sysctl, we can display the current value, and the full name is net.ipv4.tcp_keepalive_time. I'm saying it all just to let you know that IPv4, this parameter really applies to IPv6 as well. I think it's more for historical reasons that it has the name it has. If you want to change that parameter, just write a new value into it using the minus W flag. And this time, the value is in seconds. So, third program, third parameter name, third unit on our third operating system. There's not a lot of consistency here. If you want this value to stick across reboots, the easiest way is to add a line to a file called etc/sysctl.conf, like that. And once you've edited that file, you can pick up the change immediately by running sysctl minus p, and that'll apply all the parameter changes from the sysctl.conf file. So for permanent changes, that's the way I'd recommend doing it. And finally, file 43, well, not quite finally, there's a little bit more yet. Don't get too excited. On Solaris, it's, again, TCP keep alive interval. Solaris looks a lot like HP Unix, with the one difference. The NDD program is located in a different directory, so I've listed the directory there for you. On Solaris, if you want this to apply across reboots, you're going to have to edit the Solaris startup scripts to make sure that it runs this NDD command on each reboot. How exactly to do that's a little outside the scope of this presentation, but there are some pointers here which may help. On Windows, the keep alive time is, of course, in the Windows registry. So using the regedit program, you'd have to navigate to hkey local machine system current control set services TCPIP parameters. And by default, if somebody has not already set it, you will not find the keep alive time parameter. You'll have to right-click on parameters and create a new value of type D word. Keep alive time on Windows is in milliseconds, just like HP and Solaris. If the value does exist, then you can just right-click on it and enter a new value if you want to increase or decrease the keep alive time. If you want to change it, you're going to have to reboot your system, though. So bear that in mind. And problem 6, here we go. Let's confirm after our keep alive change that we are now seeing the keep alive packets. Here's another packet trace. This one is of the program AMQS-PUT-C, which is a sample PUT program. The first 3 packets, which are in gray, show that three-way handshake that establishes the connection. And then the next packets, 4, 5, 6, 7, show the channel being negotiated. KeepAlive.serverCon is how I connected to the queue manager. It shows my username being passed up for security reasons and then acknowledged. And you'll see in packets 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 that the client program connects and it opens a queue called test.ql. And that open reply is acknowledged. Then some time goes by. About 300 seconds go by. And now my server machine sends back a keep alive packet, which the Wireshark program is helpful enough to actually label it as a keep alive packet. If I weren't sure, in the first presentation I mentioned that keep alive packets have the wrong sequence number. And in fact, you'll see from packet 12, we were at sequence number 993. I should have been packet 11, which doesn't list the sequence number. Either way, it's dropped the sequence number by one. It's given the wrong number down to the client. which in packet 14 immediately replies saying, hey, that should have been sequence number 833 instead of 832. Get your numbers right. So packets 13 and 14 show the keep alive timer kicking in, and presumably every 5 minutes they're going to do that for us, even if there's no channel activity, no messages being put or anything like that. So this connection is good, even if you do have a firewall that would otherwise want to kill it. Well, there's something new in version 7 you should know about. It's a new feature that, at least for MQ client channels, might make keep alive a little less important. MQ clients have always required keep alive because if a client isn't doing an API call, it's silent on the network, doesn't send anything at all. And it can't really respond to any heartbeats that the server might be sending, so the server doesn't even send any. Well, MQ version 7 clients, talking to a version 7 queue manager, now have the ability to do heartbeats at any time. This means that in client applications, version 7 clients, MQ starts a thread whose job is to manage that connection and to respond to heartbeats. Now, this only occurs when a new attribute on the ServerCon and ClientCon channels called ShareCNV is non-zero. So if ShareCNV is set to 1 or to a higher value, then you're going to have heartbeats at any time. So a version 7 client going to a version 7 server, if you set ShareConf to 1 or more, you actually don't need to set keep alive anymore. MQ heartbeats will keep the connection lively. Your firewall will not kill it because it's been idle. But you're still probably going to need to set keep alive for some time to come because of older clients that are connecting. So problem 6, let's take a look at what the packets look like for a version 7 client. Starting at the top, packets 1, 2, and 3 are the three-way handshake again, establishing the connection. Packets 4, 5, 6 are negotiating the attributes of the channel, including the new ShareConv attribute. And then I've stripped out some of the packets after that that don't really matter so much. Those packets showed the client, it was again AMQS put C. They just show it connecting to the queue manager and opening a queue. Well, on this particular channel, I had a heartbeat interval of 5 minutes. So we see that if my client has been otherwise idle from 9:58 in the evening to 10:03, it's a bit of a late night that, as I recall, after 5 minutes, the server is going to send down to the client a bit of data, which is packet 16, highlighted in black and yellow there. And the client in packet 17 acknowledges that it receives the packet at the network level. And then in packet 18, the client sends back some data to the server acknowledging the heartbeat and saying, yep, I'm still here and I'm alive. And packet 19 is just the acknowledgement of the acknowledgement, so to speak. So 16, 17, 18, and 19 show a heartbeat going down from the server to the client and going right back up to the server. 5 more minutes go by, and actually, I think one of my timestamps there is wrong. Sorry about that, packet 19. At 8 minutes after the hour, the server again sends down the heartbeat to the client. And the client this time immediately turns around and sends the heartbeat right back to the server. Hang on a moment. Thanks for bearing with me there. Something caught my throat. So what will happen here with this version 7 client is every 5 minutes, as long as the client has no other data to send or receive, there will be a heartbeat exchange. So at 13 minutes after the hour, 18 minutes, 23 minutes, and so on forever and ever. So from the packet trace, we can confirm that this particular client is safe from having its connection terminated due to inactivity. Finally, problem 7 I threw in, just because it's a little quirk that I ran into while running some tests for this presentation. Imagine now that you've created a sender channel and a transmission queue and that you set it up with certain specific port numbers as shown below. You make the sender connect to the local host, say port 9999, which was unused on my system, and you also set its local address to 9999. An interesting thing about this particular setup, you're telling the sender channel to use a particular port and then to connect right back to that port. And even without defining a receiver channel or anything like that, if you were to attempt to start a channel like this, it would actually start up. And the reason why, for anybody who wants to try to look it up. In part one of this presentation, I mentioned some books by a fellow named Rich Stevens. And if you do happen to have a copy of any of the Stevens books, particularly TCPIP Illustrated Part 1, this is a scenario called Simultaneous Open. And the socket is actually connected to itself. This means that anything you send into the socket is immediately available to be read right back off the socket. So it's just a little quirk that allows the MQ channel to actually start and get to a running state. But if you actually try to send messages, MQ will report a protocol error and stop the channel. It's just a little quirk and something I found rather interesting. It's kind of like super-duper loopback, if you want to call it that. This isn't a problem I expect that you're going to see, but it's an example of how if you do set a lot of attributes on your MQ channels, you do have to be careful, especially when choosing port numbers. So, what have we talked about today? Well, we did a brief review of what we talked about in part one, IP, TCP/IP, or TCP, and sockets. Today, though, we went on to talk about the MQ error messages, and particularly the error node values that are reported in them, which are key to understanding what really happened. We looked at MQ channel statuses, and we looked at the TCP connection status, which we can view with the NetStat program. And they often reflect each other, but there are other times where channel status will give you more information. We also talked about debug FFSTs, how to generate one for an MQ process, particularly a channel process, and to look inside to see, well, what's this channel doing right now? We looked at stack dumps briefly, and we looked at packet traces, which really can show what's going on. If you have a very complicated channel problem and you're working with Level 2 support, you're probably going to find that we, at some point, may need to get packet traces on both ends of a channel. Make sure that the data that got sent really got received by the operating system, and so forth. And finally, we looked at Keep Alive configuration on a few different platforms, and we also talked about a new feature in version 7 that may make Keep Alive a little bit obsolete for MQ clients, or at least the very newest clients. And now moving to slide 50, I'm going to actually turn things back to Elijah, and I thank you very much for your attention. Elijah?
Thanks, Justin, for a great presentation.
And we have our first response. Sudhir Maduri.
Hi, I got a basic question. First of all, thanks for the great presentation. In your slide 3, in the TCP layers and the network layers, in your part 1 series, there's one slide which says that the Ethernet frames, the maximum transmission unit is 1500 bytes. Now, does that mean the TCP segment and the IP packet, the maximum size fit into that frame is only 1,500 bytes per packet or per segment?
Yes. That on many systems, that is actually going to be the maximum size. On more and more, I think, corporate networks, we're beginning to see some larger sizes appear. And, in fact, I actually had some in some of the tests I did later on with different packet sizes. But a common maximum transmission unit size is 1,500, which means that the TCP/IP packets will actually be a bit smaller than that.
And this is kind of related, in the same context, kind of related to the performance. If we go with, like, the maximum 1,500 bytes in WebSphere MQ for the queue, we, you know, I guess we can configure the message size to be more than 4 MB or, you know, things like that.
Right.
In that case, to improve the performance and to cut down the round trips between the sender and the receiver, is it possible to increase these frame size or, you know, frame size so that, you know, more payload can go in one shot instead of going back and forth?
It may be possible. That really, to some degree, depends on your networking hardware, the actual network cards and the routers on your network. Another thing that can help is there are tuning parameters that can control the size of the buffers that are allocated for each socket, the send buffer and the receive buffer. And making those larger can also improve performance. one thing, at least for MQ channels, is that for the most part, the packets mostly go in one direction if you're sending a batch of messages or some large messages. And only at the end of a batch of messages do we have to actually turn around and wait for the other side to reply at the MQ layer. So that limiting how often we, so to speak, turn the line around is something that does also help performance. But, yes, if you do have a corporate network or any kind of network, really, I mean, that is on a – it might be a faster network. Maybe it's gigabit Ethernet, and maybe the hardware on that network can all support larger sizes. It will certainly help performance.
I see. But the standard is, I guess, the limit is 1,500, I guess.
That's a pretty common limit, yeah. It's really all going to come down to the actual hardware that you have.
I see. If I may quickly ask, you know, based on the performance-related question.
Sure.
Now, I've seen an article where they were talking about increasing the buffer size in the queue as well. Instead of, you know, reading it from the disk, reading from the buffer, will that increase any performance or will it give any performance boost?
That may, yeah. There are some parameters, and for anybody who wants to look at these, there are some support packs for MQ, Category 2 support packs that are performance reports. So if you go to the main MQ support page, and search for the word support pack, SUPPORTPAC. You can look at the performance reports, and there are some tuning parameters for queues where you can increase how much memory is available for each queue for storing messages. Those can, in some situations, improve performance, obviously at the cost of using some extra memory. So it depends very much what your needs are and what kind of trade-offs you can make. But if you have a very large machine with plenty of memory, you can, in fact, get a benefit from that kind of thing.
I see. Now, I mean, just like in Java where there's a heap size configuration, is it
mm-hmm.
something in MQ, can we increase like a heap size?
Well, the tuning parameters that the support packs talk about are going to increase some of these buffer sizes on a per queue level. An MQ queue manager has a lot of memory that it uses, and the memory is shared between multiple processes. So rather than having a single big knob that limits how large the queue manager's memory can be, there are a bunch of different knobs in MQ that control specific areas of memory, like how much memory is available for queue buffers and stuff like that. So there's a lot more control over the memory and how it's used for a queue manager.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
As a reminder, star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. Currently, there are no questions in the queue, but I would like to take this opportunity to again remind our audience, star 1 if you'd like to ask a question, and we'll pause one moment as we wait additional responses. There are no questions at this time. I'll turn the conference over to our host for any closing or additional remarks.
Thanks. At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Justin, for presenting today.
Thank you.